Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the current economy affecting organizations with a mission to serve neighbors who have fallen on hard times? Larry James is president and CEO of City Square, formerly called Central Dallas Ministries. He and his colleagues are committed to helping North Texans find decent, affordable housing, job training, health care, and good nutrition through a variety of innovative programs, some of which recruit former recipients of assistance to provide volunteer labor and other resources after they're back on their feet. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Good to be here, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So let's go first things first. Why is City Square a better name than Central Dallas Ministries?
You know, Central Dallas Ministries served us well for 22 years, but it really doesn't describe who we are today. We're no longer just Central, if you're talking about Dallas. We're in Oak Cliff. We're downtown. We're in East Dallas. We're in South Dallas. We're not just Dallas any longer. Our summer lunch program this past summer served 18,000 children, 701,000 meals from Denton to Duncanville on the east side of the Metroplex. We have an organization in San Antonio. We have an organization in Austin. Ministries has always been a bit problematic. If folks wanted us to be more religion-oriented, they were kind of disappointed because we're so Franciscan, preaching the gospel at all times, using words only when necessary. And so they would sometimes wonder about that. On the other hand, the more secular observer, or one who is in a funding organization that was blocked in terms of funding religious organizations, didn't really understand how we approached our work. And so our board decided we need to take a look at this, and thanks to the Richards Group, who cut us a really nice deal, we went through an 18-month spherical branding process and came up with City Square, which begs the question, what does that mean? Whereas Central Dallas Ministries sent people off on rabbit trails with all kinds of assumptions about what it meant, and we had to spend our time reeling them back in. And so City Square, for us, is inviting. It conjures up the idea of inclusion. Everyone is welcome. Our little logo is very porous, uniting people and yet leaving space for others always to come in. It's a place where institutions exist alongside communities and individuals, schools, faith communities, businesses, financial resources, just the old-time vision of a city square, kind of Savannah, Georgia-like with 24 squares. You can build a square in your mind or in your work anywhere in a metropolitan area like this and bring people together. We also want to square things up in Dallas. Some things are a little
fair
out of square.
Fair
and square. And so, you know, it kind of goes on and on with its implications, but we're very excited about the name, and it's been well received so far.
As long as we're talking about terminology, the people who receive help from City Square, you call them neighbors rather than clients or recipients. Talk about that term for me.
Yeah. From the early days, I've been at City Square 16 years. We found that things work best when we regarded one another as neighbors, where that relationships founded on reciprocity and mutual benefit really advanced the work of community development, so that folks who were coming to us for assistance were invited to stay and help us fashion programming, craft responses to impoverished situations, and actually deliver services, so that we were all on equal footing, peers and partners, rather than projects or problems. And so that's just been a value, a very consistent core value of City Square from the beginning, at least of my tenure.
Well, it makes perfect sense that when you talk about helping a neighbor, that sounds very different than contributing to a charity somehow.
Right, right. You know, it's a matter of extending a hand up to a friend rather than providing a handout as a stranger. And so we eliminate the stranger business, and we don't have handouts. And so it's a dynamic, inviting kind of environment. And all of our ideas about programming have come by listening to the community of neighbors that we have assembled.
Why is that for other organizations such a challenge? It seems to make sense that if you want to help people up, you are going to sort of communicate. But then often it seems like, well, people have gotten, a lot of people perceive that people have gotten themselves in trouble because they've made bad choices or they've done things that cause them to deserve sort of being where they are.
Yeah, there is a philosophical issue that you just described. It's really theological. It's not new. We see it in the pages of the New Testament when Jesus approached the blind man on one occasion, those around said, "Who sinned, this man or his parents?" And so in the past, illness was considered to be the result of some mistake or sin or indiscretion on someone's part. Today, the new illness is poverty, so that if you're poor, there must be something wrong, or if you're sociologically challenged economically, there must be something wrong with you. What have you done? Kind of Calvinistic, really. It's mm-hmm. almost like wealth becomes the mark of election in our culture, and that's really unorthodox in my theology for sure. Poverty is a result of many forces. Many and most, the most powerful, are systemic. Laziness and stupidity are spread at about the same depth across the entire socioeconomic continuum, and so they're really not the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you begin to get into these neighborhoods with neighbors and you begin to regard people as your friends, you begin to craft solutions. There's also a practical matter. I think one of the reasons why many organizations do not involve their clients in service or in this kind of engagement is simply efficiency. You know, we're a right efficient culture here in Dallas. We like to get things done. We like to count nickels and noses. We like to push people through, and we like to get the work done. We're here to do the work. Let's get it done. Let's don't fool around. Community development that employs a neighbor strategy it actually gets just as many people through in a more productive way, but it's a little more messy. It's a little...
A lot of cooks stirring the
lots
broth.
Lots of cooks. So it's not quite as tidy. The canned corn's not quite as straight in the pantry, mm-hmm. but the affect and the benefit to those involved is just really, really amazing.
Well, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago. You talked about Calvinistic ideology and systemic poverty, and the reality is, for most Americans, if you are born poor, you are very likely to stay poor.
That's right.
And so talk about how you get up every morning and knowing that, continue to go to work and believe that it's possible for some people to pull out of it.
You know, that's a great question, and I ask myself that question often, and I'm asked that question often. First of all, it's the right thing to do for me. And even more important, someone asked recently, what's the best thing about your job, and what area of our work do you like most, do you appreciate most? And I said, the best thing about my job would be the people with whom I work, both our staff and our neighbors. And I am energized by the wealth, the social capital. That's the other thing. We measure too much materially, and we neglect to measure the spiritual or the human side.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this incredible wealth of human capital and creativity and laughter and theological understanding and common sense that resides among those who happen to be economically disadvantaged. And that is incredibly energizing, and I am energized by that. And so, you know, I receive much, much more than I give. And so I'm motivated by the people with whom I work and the people that we encounter as we work.
Are staff members and volunteers with City Square right now having to adjust to a different mentality among those who have never expected to need help before?
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. The current Great Recession has affected thousands and thousands of people in the Metroplex. And we are seeing people now who have never been in environments like ours, which, in my opinion, makes our approach even more important
mm-hmm.
because we want to invite people to come into a place where they can take a deep breath and begin to regain hope. And that's what we're all about. We're hope merchants on our best days. The demand is through the roof. At our food distribution center, we're up over 26% through the first three quarters compared to last year's mm-hmm. first three quarters.
And last year was not an easy year either.
It was not an easy year either. Before I came over to the studio, I asked one of our outcomes persons, I said, you know, where are we? And we're going to see 50,000 different unduplicated individuals during 2010.
Wow.
That's an enormous growth. And on the one hand, it's very challenging, difficult, and depressing. On the other hand, because of our approach to people, it's incredibly energizing, and we're trying to bring that hope to bear on the problems.
We had a conversation last week on the show, the televised version, with the directors of the North Texas Food Bank and the Tarrant Area Food Bank. And they were saying that for them, they've found that, food aid is now becoming, people are coming with chronic need as opposed to emergency need. Is that,
is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And that's been true with us for a long time, but it spiked because of the recession. It's absolutely true. We are in a partnership with the North Texas Food Bank. Of course, we receive 99% of our food from them. But we now have SNAP workers, or food SNAP workers, in our center, and we're enrolling people in that public benefit, which is good for them, providing some stability to the food needs. It's also good for all the rest of us because they spend those food SNAP dollars in local grocery stores. We often forget that providing investments in low-income families is not like just pouring your money down a dark hole. Rather, it's investing in people who then begin to invest in the community again. And that's something we've got to come to grips with as a community in terms of public policy.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Characterize, if you would, the government programs that seem to be working pretty effectively given the situation, and the ones that, in your opinion, could use an overhaul.
Well, actually, I think we have found most public sector workers and administrators to be incredibly competent and committed to what they do, and most of the programs that they're administering are very important and effective. We mentioned SNAP. It's interesting to note that in 2008, according to the Texas Hunger Initiative, Dallas County left over $500 million on the table in food stamp dollars that should have been placed in the hands of eligible recipients, but those people were not enrolled. Now, forget about the people who received and used the food stamps. Let's go back to Kroger or Tom Thumb. $500 million lost to retail grocers. That doesn't make any sense. Those are dollars that we've paid to D.C. that we need to get back to Texas, to get back to Dallas. And because we don't, those dollars go to Philadelphia and Chicago and Seattle and other communities who understand the economic benefit and impact of this kind of public investment in people. The same thing is true, of course, of WIC, the Women, Infants, Children Nutrition Program. It's also true of the CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Program, administered by the state. It's true of Medicaid. It's true of HUD's housing vouchers and continuum of care dollars that we receive in Dallas. We have 105 apartments in Southwest Oak Cliff that house previously chronically homeless disabled individuals. And those folks moving from the street to permanent supportive housing as a first move are doing really, really well. We couldn't do that without that public support. I mentioned the summer lunch program. In a partnership this year with PepsiCo and our AmeriCorps team, we were able to move our numbers from about 350,000 served in 2009 to over 700,000 served in 2010 during the summer. Across the country, about 30 million children receive free and reduced lunches in public schools during the school year. In the summer, that number drops to under 3 million. So there's a huge logistics problem, and we've added a mobile delivery component to our program site-based component, thanks to a partnership with PepsiCo. I could go on and on talking about the benefits. AmeriCorps is another example. We have 100 year-round members. In the summer, it grows to 350, mostly young people who are getting a great experience, and the public investment is small compared to the benefit they bring to a community. We're fortunate to have those partnerships, and there are public solutions we have to engage.
Larry James is my guest. He's president and CEO of City Square, formerly Central Dallas Ministries. We're talking about fighting against poverty and injustice in North Texas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is President and CEO of City Square, Larry James. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So this has been sort of a banner year for you based on the completion of City Walk. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. City Walk is a mixed-use, mixed-income residential community in the heart of downtown Dallas on the edge of the Arts District, located at 511 North Ackard, right across the street from the T. Boone Pickens YMCA and from Lincoln Plaza. It's a really cool, complicated, and I must say innovative project. It uses three sources of public tax credits to finance itself in part. We have new markets tax credits used from basement to three, which is office retail. We have low-income housing tax credits from the state of Texas, which it was used to develop the residential piece, which is floors 4 through 14, 200 units of affordable housing. 100 of those units are set aside for persons seriously in danger of becoming homeless or persons who were in the past homeless. Mm-hmm. And the other 100 units are means-tested market units, which means that you could earn up to about $28,000 annually and live in one of those units. And then the 15th and 16th floors are six market-rate condos for sale. And we have commitments for four of those. We've pre-sold four of those. It's a great building. On the first floor, we have a commercial entity in 7-Eleven. The second floor is currently vacant but is about to be occupied by a couple of nonprofit organizations. The City Walk administrative staff and our public interest law firm and our community development corporation are on the third floor. And so we're in the building every day with the wonderful people who live there. We only have five vacancies currently. And so if anyone would like to live downtown and they can qualify by the means test, we'd love to talk to them. It's a great dynamic community. The people who are there are so grateful for the quality of the housing and the programming that goes on there, which is really concierge type. It's a housing first model on the homeless side, so that the only real requirements beyond the means testing is just for people to be good tenants. And we've had a great experience so far.
What's the plan with the means testing? If someone is right on the line and gets a raise or something, do they have a notice to vacate, or how does that work?
Yeah, there's a process, but if a person's income rises above that level, they have to begin to transition out.
Mm-hmm. And what's the advantage of being downtown? People say, well, you could get cheaper housing, you know, 30
sure.
miles outside the city.
Well, it's just so dynamic, and most of our residents in the building, those who are on the means-tested side who work downtown. They work in the hotels. They work in the office buildings. They work in the restaurants. It's no surprise to anyone, not news to anyone, downtown Dallas is really coming back strong. And, you know, one of the indicators, one of my friends and one of our supporters says, you know, you can tell when a city's coming back when you see people walking dogs in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're everywhere downtown now. And so we have dogs in our building, you know, which is kind of a sign that we have real community life going on. But to be downtown is so wonderful. And the Green Line is a block and a half from our front door. And so you've got the rail readily available if you need to go somewhere else in the city. And many of our tenants don't have cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a good place. It's a good place to be.
I had to laugh. I looked at the website, and it said pets were welcome up to 35 pounds.
Yeah,
and
that
includes cats. If you have a 35-pound cat, I don't know.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Billy in Dallas. Hi, Billy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I was giving a call is because, Larry, we've met before, but I was curious about your dedication to the reentry of formerly incarcerated individuals in Dallas.
Yeah.
I know that the Dallas City program has stalled, and there's a couple of operations to help end recidivism. Are you working with Craig Watkins at all helping these guys to get a job and get their life back together. And I guess the question would be, are you in favor of the city ending the check the box campaign? And I'll hang up and listen.
Yes, I appreciate that. That question. I'm not familiar with the city's check the box campaign, so someone needs to enlighten me about that. I am very familiar with the practical reality that faces folks who are exiting prison in the state of Texas. My mind goes in so many different directions. I'm actually on the board of directors of the Doors organization, which sprang out of Safer Dallas movement. And we do, in fact, in our City Square Work Paths program, we provide employment training for ex-offenders who have been released back into the community. We provide some housing for some of those same people because, as you know, Billy, the problem with an ex-offender is, or ex-incarcerated, we're learning some were not offenders but falsely accused, but ex-incarcerated folks have a problem getting a place to live and getting a job if they're honest, if they admit that they've had the problem. And so felonies in Texas are really crippling. And, yes, we are working with that population very actively. Reverend Gerald Britt, who is our director of public policy as well as community program development, has been working on this issue for some time. And it's becoming more and more important to us. The story of the exonerees largely is a Craig Watkins story in terms of criminal justice enforcement. We've worked closely with the almost 30 exonerees in Dallas County who were released from prison after being falsely indicted and imprisoned. And as a matter of fact, those gentlemen met in our building for several months as a group, and so we're very close to that. But you've put your finger on a very, very difficult and important problem in our community. We send too many people to prison in Texas. Many of the folks who go to prison with drug issues would do far better at far lower expense to the state and to all of us if they were placed in treatment. And there are some divert courts. My friend John Creuzot is a great judge who basically has assumed the role of counselor to scores of men and women who have been charged with drug abuse issues but who shouldn't be going to prison but should rather seek treatment and should seek the kind of help that is available elsewhere. And Judge Creuzot and some other judges are championing that movement in our community, and I applaud that. We've got to do better about how we treat people who make mistakes.
We talked on the show a couple of weeks ago about the huge prison industry in Texas and the reality that even when there are job training programs provided within prisons, many times inmates are being trained for jobs that don't exist once you get out there, and not even just formerly incarcerated people. But how do you set up job training programs and monitor sort of what's going on economically in North Texas to make sure that you're training people for jobs that they can get placed in?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure we're sophisticated enough along those lines. We could be doing a better job, I'm sure. What we do have in place is sort of a threefold approach. We have a pretty dynamic, robust computer technology training center that is staffed by an El Centro professor who trains people in all the Microsoft products. Thanks to Microsoft and a grant we received twice now, we have all their products and all the licenses to all their products free. So that's one piece. We also have a 13-week construction training program that is focused on brownfield remediation and hazmat material construction. And people in that class are trained in plumbing, electrical, framing, roofing, HVAC, all the different trades with a hazmat sort of emphasis, a green emphasis. And we've been very successful in getting people jobs out of that program. And some of the people who've been employed have been ex-offenders. But thanks to our relationship with employers, we serve as sort of a broker. Mm-hmm. And so they know, having come through our training program, there's sort of a seal of approval there that makes employers more open to hiring ex-offenders. And then we have a soft skills getting ready for work initiative that's common sense stuff like, you know, show up early, stay late, don't steal. Pretty soon you'll be the boss. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of thing.
That works around here.
You know, and that's been highly successful as well. But we have much more to do and much more to learn. It's hard to track folks once they leave your program, mm-hmm. unless this. You have a very determined, highly relational approach. And this goes back to the whole neighbor issue. We put people through kind of a survivor process to get into the construction trade program. So maybe 90 or 100 people will apply for 30 positions, and they go through this 3-day competition. And some are, 75 or so are kicked off the island. Mm-hmm. And the 25 that make it are so relieved they made it, they don't leave the program.
Mm-hmm.
And the others who don't make it the first round, we encourage to come into one of our other programs and try again. And so innovation and understanding the market needs, very important, and we need to improve on that.
Do you think some of the success you've had in placing people out of that program is because, when you talk about hazmat remediation, that sounds like one of those jobs that people would not choose unless they have no other option?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely true. And of course, the training provides the kind of safety considerations, and there's a mentoring piece inside that encourages people to take full advantage of the opportunity that's there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Larry James, President and CEO of City Square. Let's go next to Richardson and speak with Tim. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I hate to inject a note of reality or possibly bitterness into this conversation, but your guest sounds like his organization's doing wonderful work, but I'd like to ask him about I'm somebody who could donate to organizations myself, but I want to give him two examples of my experience with charities. One is a family who lives across the street from us here in Richardson, who is collecting $500-$600 in assistance every month fraudulently, and they throw away more free food every week than, frankly, our household eats in a week. That's number one. They've been reported. Nothing's been done about it. She's been collecting this assistance fraudulently for several years now. Mm. Nothing's done about it. Contrast that with an elderly neighbor I have, another one, who actually does need assistance. And I have tried, she's in her 80s, I've tried to apply for her at a number of different organizations, including Network here in Richardson. And I've been told she's housebound and she's in her 80s, and she's also very proud. I've been told, well, you need to bring in her utility bills, her driver's license, her Social Security card, proof that she's a citizen, all of this other stuff. None of them help her except for one organization here in Richardson, which actually provides food for her dog for free. And as somebody who is in a position to be able to give money, the organizations that – and what I see with the people across the street, I'm totally disgusted with how charities work at this point. And I would hope that your guest's organization is different, but I don't think I'm not average when it comes to seeing this kind of waste in a lot of charities also. And I'd just like to find out his point of view. And
sure.
Actually, if there's really anything anybody can do, if there's somebody who's actually getting assistance fraudulently and they don't deserve it and it's being taken away from somebody else.
All right. I think we've got your point, Tim, and I appreciate it. Let's get a response for you.
Yeah, Tim, thank you very much for your inquiry. And I share your frustration. I'm assuming from your description that the people across the street are receiving some sort of assistance from a private charity. I can tell you that if you call me about such a matter, we would certainly investigate and look into it and try to adjust our response. And we would, frankly, the first thing we would do is talk to the person that you're concerned about. So I share your frustration there. As I said earlier, this sort of fraudulent behavior is spread at about the same depth across the socioeconomic continuum, and I can give you lots of examples on the upper end, and I can give you some examples on the lower end, and all along the range. I'm real concerned about the elderly lady next door. I don't know if there's a way for you to call back off air and leave me your telephone number, or just contact me at ljames@citysq.org, and let's get together and see if we can't help this lady. We do this kind of thing all the time, and the fact that she's homebound is not a deterrent. We don't normally deliver food like that, but it sounds to me like you've got a case that you care about, and the fact that you're next door would be the best thing about it. And we would love to work with you to try to figure out a way to assist this person.
MJ in the control room, if you can pick back up with Tim and get his contact info, that would be great.
I really like to talk to you.
You know, Tim's frustration, though, I think a lot of people share the concern that providing aid to people makes it easier for people not to, to want to help themselves. Can you speak to your perspective on that?
Yeah. Again, I think there are some people where that is true. There's also at a deeper level, there is this what I would call the scourge of hopelessness that begins to affect people who are in poverty for a long period of time. Someone once said that hopelessness strung out for many years begins to resemble laziness an awful lot. And I think we mistake what we're seeing, and we sometimes think that people who are hopeless and resigned are just simply they don't care or that they're lazy. I had a woman approach me years ago who lived in public housing, and she was an elderly lady. She was a grandmother. And she said, "Larry, we carry our grief here in buckets. We've all lost so much." I think you have to be willing to hear people speak out of their pain to really understand sometimes what's going on. Are there people who take advantage of the system? Absolutely. You name the system, they're there. I mean, there are people who take advantage of City Square, both clients who've been there in the past and clients who will come tomorrow. But that's true across every institution in our culture. And you can't be defined by the anecdotal minority report of a few people who, for whatever reason, are making bad choices. You know, we challenge people. That's the other thing about it. We're not a soft-headed organization. If you're passed out on our front doorstep, we're going to take care of you until you can get up on your feet and breathe, and your only responsibility at that point is to stay alive. Once you get up, we're going to challenge you to use your talents and abilities, your capital, to the maximum. And if you're not willing, if you're not ready for that, and you want to invest your talent in a crack house somewhere or in some sort of behavior that's counterproductive to the community, we're going to probably send you along and tell you, come back when you're ready. You're not. We don't have time to waste on you if you're not ready. And that sounds kind of hard, but we're pretty hard-nosed and confrontational.
Larry James is my guest. He's president and CEO of City Square, formerly Central Dallas Ministries. If you're interested in the organization, you can learn more about them at citysq.org. If you'd like to join the conversation now, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Larry James. He is president and CEO of City Square. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I know, Larry, that City Square and a lot of other similar organizations partner with other groups. Are you, though, in a time like this, in some ways in competition with them for sources of funding?
Yeah, that's certainly one way to look at it, because when you're writing grants to a foundation or a corporation, or I mean, even more recently to United Way, an organization that's gone to all grant making, there's a limited number of dollars, and you're vying for those dollars with some of your partners in the city. So yeah, there is competition in that regard. The higher ground, of course, is to collaborate to accomplish things. And an example that comes to mind is Citibank. Had a fund that they were administering through the United Way that was designed to lift people out of poverty. And we applied for it along with the YW here in Dallas. And United Way, as a faithful broker, approached the YW and us and said, you know, you're vying for the same money. Why don't you combine your programs? And so that's what we're doing. And so now we have a great new partnership with the YW. And they have been incredibly gracious in terms of how the money was allocated, because we were doing a certain piece that it cost more than what they were going to do, and they saw that it would be best to the success of the endeavor to give it to us, and so they did. So there are ways to find in the midst of competition, there are ways to find collaborative solutions and partnerships that will advance us further than if we operate independently. And I've got several examples of that in my experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Yvonne in Dallas. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
My name is Marv Yvonne Brown. I just called to talk about partnerships and to thank Larry for what he does in the North Dallas Roseland community. We do have a partnership with Housing Authority and J.W. Ray, and partnerships make it work. And that's one thing I know that City Square does well, and the community is very responsive to all the services they offer. Now, are we there yet? No, but because of organizations like City Square, they've been enabled to get a lot of programs they wouldn't normally have had. So partnerships are very big. They don't have to be a competition. They truly should be a collaboration. And I just wanted to thank Larry for what City Square is doing in that neighborhood, and the residents are so grateful and thankful to him. And Larry, I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you, Marva. It's good to hear your voice.
What goes on at Roseland?
We have been in Roseland Home since 1996. We started there doing summer camps for children, and we had a couple of hundred kids every day for 9 weeks in the summer of 1996. And after that summer, we, through a relationship with Miss Anisha Lewis, who was a property manager at that time, we began to bring other products into the community. And this was before the Hope 6 renovation of Roseland Homes. So it was Roseland Homes is the oldest public housing development west of the Mississippi. It's a HUD development. And it was in bad shape. There were constant shootings and all kinds of problems there when we first went. And we began to move services in, employment training, health care, legal services. And now, today, the Housing Authority has engaged us to manage their new community life center there. And we have that recreation program. We have an after-school program there that's based on homework and mentoring and recreation. We have an after-school academy there that is based on experiential learning. We have a teen university that's focused on getting kids to consider college. We have a UConnect station where we bring technology to bear. We're doing lots of different things at Roseland Homes.
And when you mentioned summer camps, I just want to go back. A lot of people don't think about it, but this is essentially child care for working parents.
That's
in the
right.
Summer.
That's absolutely correct.
We have an email here from Randy who asks, any comments on the political threat to Medicaid in Texas? How would changes impact those on Medicaid and your work at City Square?
Well, we have a community health clinic, and I appreciate that email, Randy. We have a community health clinic that serves between 2,000 and 2,500 individuals and serves them as a medical home. And we do chronic disease set management, especially diabetes, hypertension, depression, asthma, those kinds of things. So we have it's a medical home for people. It's like it's an appointment clinic. It's like where I go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
We don't serve people who are eligible for public benefits like Medicaid. So we're serving uninsured folks, many of whom are Hispanic, right? So changing Medicaid, as some are suggesting that we do in Texas, would on the surface not have any impact because we don't receive any Medicaid dollars. But at the front door, I fear and suspect it would have great impact because we'd start seeing more of those folks coming to us. The notion that a state like Texas – that already doesn't fully fund Medicaid can come up with its own public health program for Medicaid-eligible recipients is, I believe, short-sighted, if not downright foolish, and probably is just political rhetoric. The Medicare programs, both very different, are amazingly efficiently administered. And when expanded, they bring public health improvement, and we need to expand them. We also need to revise the policy about both Medicaid and Medicare and CHIP in terms of what they will cover. Preventive activities, diet, exercise, chronic disease set management, those kinds of community health workers. We have a group of community health workers who actually, they're trained as community health workers, but high school graduates from the community mm-hmm. have managed cohorts of diabetics very successfully and saved our healthcare system in Dallas hundreds of thousands of dollars over the last decade in our little clinic. Those kinds of activities need to be qualified and eligible to be Medicaid and Medicare reimbursed. Because, you know, as Ken Cooper said recently in a speech at the Cooper Center, public health reform is wonderful and necessary probably, but if we don't get some of these chronic disease sets under control, the nation will be bankrupt. And so we've got big, big challenges in community health improvement in the United States.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I just had a quick comment about the caller who called earlier. I think his name is Tim, who had the frustrating situation with his neighbors. I was wondering, you know, why is it that so many people feel powerless to directly intervene for people that they know? I mean, his elderly neighbor who's homebound, dollar for dollar, he's going to be better able to provide help for her. And it sounds like he's already got some income that he was planning on donating anyway. And he would have zero overhead costs, but yet he feels like he needs to try to find a good charity or one that's well-run or efficient to do that.
Yes. While I wouldn't sit in judgment of Tim, I know nothing about his personal circumstance or what he's facing individually, and so I'm not going to question his motives at all. I think that you are right that taking care of one another in community is what this is all about. And next-door neighbors and folks from across the street or in a public school or in a church or a synagogue or a mosque or wherever we find friends and where we develop friendships, certainly that should be the first line of defense against these problems. You're exactly right.
Do you get the sense that people worry that once they take one step that they are sort of bound to someone? I mean, and I hate to draw this analogy, but there are people who won't feed cats because they're afraid that the cats will come back and starve without their help if they can't provide it.
I think there is a fear of not knowing what's best. Mm-hmm. There is a fear of getting into something one can't control. There is a realistic understanding of what one's limitations are. And so there may be the charitable nonprofit organization may be somehow seen as a buffer to those issues. That said, I still believe extending oneself to the people around is not only the right thing to do, it's healthy and the best thing to do in the long run. You're probably going to fall into situations that you can't always handle, and you may feel taken advantage of at times, but being human with others is really, really important.
What do you do at City Square when demand outstrips resources?
That's happened this year. Mm-hmm. And this has been a very, very exciting year for us. It's been a groundbreaking year, and it's been the hardest year since I've been here. Because as the needs have risen, we've overextended ourselves during a year when we were already extending ourselves in new directions. And so this has been a tough year. We do everything we can for as long as we can, for as many people as we can. And then we regroup and try to go forward and raise some more money or cut some costs somewhere, and we just keep trying. It's been challenging, Chris. It's been very difficult. And I think that's been the story kind of across the sector. As I talk to my friends who are in nonprofit management, everyone's smarting in this economy for two reasons. Funding's down because income's down, and needs are up because income's down. And mm-hmm. so it's tough.
Do you have to prioritize? Is it children and the elderly first? Do you have criteria like
that? You know, what we attempt to do is look at impact. Mm-hmm. We want to be there with the high impact stuff. And that then is tempered by a consideration of what is absolutely necessary. The necessity that a neighbor is facing or bringing forward. And then where is our greatest impact? And so we're seeing ourselves over the longer term shifting toward employment training. We're working more in public policy. We're linking nutrition to health mm-hmm. in a very determined way, thanks to a partnership we have with Crossroads Community Service, our community services, which is a ministry of the First United Methodist Church here in Dallas and is led by Jay Cole, my good friend. We've indexed all of our food to health considerations and lifestyle considerations. So we just make tough choices, and sometimes we have to stop doing things and in order to preserve income, guard limited income against the need we know that is rising in another area.
I'm sure you won't disagree that there is nothing wrong with people feeling especially generous between Thanksgiving and New Year's.
But sure.
I wonder if it's also challenging. How do you get people who really feel moved to do something for Christmas or for the holidays to come back again in June or March?
Yeah. Well, again, another very insightful question. There is a predictable cycle in our year. And so we know that. And so we anticipate it as much as we can. And we plan for it. In regard to getting the year-end donor, and I understand that, people make significant gifts at the end of the year once they consider what their year has been financially mm-hmm. and once they consider the tax implications, et cetera. And so we do our very best to create friendships and long-term relationships, deeper relationships with our donors throughout the year, attempting to draw people back into an investment position with our organization. And we have a number of donors who are invested in our work, who are monthly givers, people who are making estate plans based on what they know about our work, people who've been with us from the very beginning, some of the founders who are still amazingly committed to what we're doing.
Are you able to predict how this year will shake out based on what you've seen so far?
I was telling our chief financial officer earlier today that I think on the revenue side, we should plan for a repeat of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should project additional revenue for next year and then budget on the expense side, on the bottom of the chart side, with that in mind. That means another tough year. Now, if we get mid-year and what seems to be the beginning of a little recovery begins to really kick in, then we can adjust. One of my board members said the other night, you can always add at mid-year if you're doing better than you thought. We're notorious for overextending ourselves, and that's my fault. That's my fault.
Is it because you get excited about trying something different?
We just worry, the eternal optimism sometimes can shoot you in the foot. And we've got great people on the ground who are at the frontline folks who have amazing heart and a great sense of mission and calling to this. And therefore, when you get, when someone's a neighbor, that sort of deprofessionalizes a relationship and opens it up, maybe more to the concerns we were talking about a while ago of helping someone next door. And so you overextend yourself at times, and then you have to regroup. And we got a great development team who are doing their very best to keep us going. And we've diversified our funding over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, something just under 40% of our funding comes from public sources. City, county, state, and federal.
In the last 10 seconds, is North Texas a generous place?
Absolutely. Very generous. I'm hoping that they would be increasingly generous to those organizations that address poverty.
Larry James is president and CEO of City Square, formerly Central Dallas Ministries. You can learn more about the organization and its efforts online at citysq.org. Larry, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to see you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.